Welcome to Attached, a platform for adding breadth and depth to everyday living. I'm Yaakov Danishevsky, and this is the conversation series focused on my book. In each episode, I invite a special guest to discuss the topic of a particular chapter and how it relates to our lives.
Okay. So welcome back to another Conversations episode. In this conversation, we're going to discuss the chapter called Body Wisdom, which I'm really excited about. It's actually one of the aspects of the book that I'm most passionate about. And I'm very excited because I have with me today Dr. Gavriel Fagan, Rabbi Dr. Gavriel Fagan, who is very well known, hopefully to most of you, most of us. But I've also had the personal privilege of getting to work with Dr. Fagan on a number of cases and to consult with him and seek out his wisdom and input. And beyond all the amazing insight and help he has provided for me professionally on certain cases and situations, he's also just somebody that I connected with, at least I feel, very quickly in a personal way. He's very warm and exciting and fun to be around and very enjoyable to spend time with. So thank you for making the time from your busy schedule to join me today, Dr. Fagan.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and thanks for agreeing to take a look at the book and to have this conversation. So I'm curious, I had asked you if you would choose one of the chapters that interested you most from the beginning section, and you chose Body Wisdom. So I'm curious to hear from you why that was the one that you wanted to explore together.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I work a lot with sexual abuse survivors, sexual abuse thrivers, as well as perpetrators of sexual abuse and those individuals that, you know, kind of run the gamut of sexual issues in their life. And from both the victim standpoint, as well as really from the perpetrator standpoint, the whole idea of body wisdom, you know, is terribly important when it comes to the clinical work and kind of really trying to understand their experience and some of the dynamics. And so those are kind of like two categories, you know, the victim end and the perpetrator end. And then there's kind of like a third demographic of spouses, male spouses of women who have been sexually abused, and to try to tune them in to what their spouse might be going through because of their sexual abuse, and to help them to understand, you know, that certain reactions, whether it's emotional or physical, have a lot to do with the trauma and don't necessarily have to do with them, and to try to help them, you know, kind of make that separation so that they can actually be supportive and helpful in the process and not, you know, kind of work off of being insulted or, you know, that kind of thing. So it, you know, the chapter really, really spoke to me when I read the book, you know, initially, you know, and it really spoke to me in terms of the clinical work. So, and I hope it wasn't too cliche. Mm. But.
Not at all. So let's try and build this maybe kind of one step at a time. Let's go back a little bit. So just to lay out what the chapter is for anyone who has or hasn't read it, in a very quick summary, the chapter on body wisdom is about the idea that we have been in many ways influenced to think that our conscious, rational, linear type of thinking and mind is the be-all and end-all of truths. And our access to knowledge is from our access to truth and our access to knowledge of ourselves and of the world around us is really in our thinking in ways that are the types of thinking that we learn in school, in classrooms, in textbooks, and those kinds of things. 1 + 1 = 2. And if I can see something, so then it's there, and et cetera. These kinds of very rational forms of thought, analytical thought. I can prove something, something's concrete, it's something tangible. And there's obviously a lot of truth to that. That type of thinking has a tremendous amount of value in our lives and in our world. But what the idea of body wisdom that I developed in that chapter, not my own ideas, but developing from other people, is that we actually have a much deeper knowledge than that. We have an intuition, we have a gut feeling, We have the ability to tell what feels true to us through what resonates and what doesn't resonate. We have an unconscious mind. There's a lot more wisdom within ourselves and within the world that goes beyond what we can consciously prove in a tangible type of way. And so I talk about that in that context in terms of the ability to know that God exists. And so knowing that God exists, what I'm arguing, is something that we know through our body wisdom, through, in a philosophical sense, the fact that we even know that we exist, right? Rationally, we can argue, is there any way to actually prove that I exist, or that the microphone I'm speaking into actually exists, or that this conversation is happening anywhere outside of my own mind? Rationally, philosophically, we can question all of that. And there really actually is no conclusive proof, as ridiculous as that sounds. But the reason it sounds ridiculous is precisely for this reason, because we intuitively, instinctively know that clearly this is happening. I'm experiencing it right now, right? So the joke that some philosophers have is, did the person writing the paper that says why no people exist, or why no physical objects exist, so who was he writing the paper for, and did he believe the pen he was writing with actually existed or not, right? And the point being that obviously he did think people exist, and he did think the pen existed, because you can't actually escape the experiential knowledge you have, the direct immediate contact with experience that you have. And so body wisdom is what really guides us to that, the ability to connect with our body, to listen to our body, to the sensations in our body, to the gut feelings in our body, to the intuitions that live in our body that go beyond the rational mind. So that's the basic idea. Dr. Fagan, if you have anything to add or change about the way I formulated that, I'd be really curious to hear. And then also, if you could then maybe speak out a little bit more of what you were saying before about how that plays itself out in the context of people who have experienced sexual abuse, either on the victim or the perpetrator side, or the spouses of victims.
No, I think you said it beautifully. You know, should write a book about it or something. But I'll share with you I'll share with you a little vignette. I double majored in college. I double majored in psychology and philosophy, and our philosophy final, before I was able to graduate, they brought all three philosophy majors. I mean, it was a huge major in college, but so they brought all three philosophy majors who were graduating that year into a room. And the assignment, our final assignment, was to write a philosophical question and its answer. And so I posed the philosophical question, why, and answered the question, because I feel it to be true. And handed in this final, knowing full well that, you know, I was kind of taking a risk, and, you know, finishing after about, you know, 2.5 minutes, you know, and everybody else was kind of sitting there for 4 or 5 hours.
That's
I wound up
great.
Getting an A on the paper, which was good. But, you know, it kind of sparked, you know, the chapter kind of sparked that memory, because we this is something that I was going to, you know, speak about in a little bit, but I think it's probably the right time. We don't teach feelings to our kids, especially in an academic setting. As you know, as parents, we try very, very hard to try to teach feelings. When I, or more likely when my wife, you know, asks our kids, you know, how do you feel about X, Y, or Z? So angry, mad, happy, sad are off. You can't use those words, because they're really not all that descriptive. You have to find a different word. Now, they're all, you know, synonyms of one another, but, you know, try to find a way to be descriptive. But
do you actually implement that in your house? That's really interesting.
Yes, but quite honestly, it's my
What age do you start that at, that they can no longer use? What was that?
It's my idea, my wife's implementation. So, you know, this is
Right. What age do those basics become no longer options?
Well, it's a good question. Probably, you know, 4 or 5. But, you know, as the youngest kind of hear the conversation from the oldest, they kind of like pick up on the house rules.
Sure.
To a point where I forget which child, but, you know, kind of somewhere in between, came up with the word exciterverse, which is
that's
excited
awesome.
And nervous all at the same time. So, you know, being able to kind of like describe something in language that actually made sense, you know, to them was something that was important. So now, you know, in our lexicon of feelings at home, there's, you know, Exciterverse.
But Exciterverse, that's great.
I think that, you know, one of the points is you know, and really comes out from the chapter is we really don't teach feelings. You know, you mentioned in the chapter, you have the, you know, the laminated feelings wheel, you know, kind of on the wall. If we think about that, right, what a terrible shame that as therapists, we need to hang a feelings wheel, right, on a wall.
Yeah.
Because people don't have the language. And the reason they don't have the language is because we've never spoken to them that way. And we don't necessarily promote it. We, you know, especially let's say, you know, boys in yeshiva, it's, you know, it's beautiful. It's a lot of time being spent, you know, on Gemara and, you know, really analytical analysis. But there really is no time being spent on getting in touch with feelings and respecting feelings, you know, and respecting an experience of something that's coming out. The only other point, you know, I'll kind of add is that this gets even more challenging, you know. You know, I have a pretty heavy Hasidish demographic of individuals, you know, who I see. And in Yiddish, this becomes even more challenging because, you know, if we already don't utilize, you know, English vocabulary, in Yiddish, the amount of feeling words that actually exist, right, you're kind of basically stuck at angry, mad, happy, sad. And you know, it becomes extraordinarily challenging to actually feel and experience an emotion if you can't label it and understand it. And you know, that can cause a lot of frustration and a lot of built up animosity, which is, you know, kind of you know, this theme in the book.
That is so interesting. I want to pause on that for a second. I never heard that. I don't know Yiddish. I did go to a yeshiva at one point for about 3.5 months where Shir was in Yiddish, but I didn't actually know Yiddish. So I had to spend my night Seder reviewing somebody's notes that were in Hebrew. By the end of it, I caught on a little bit, but I don't really know Yiddish. That I never heard that before. That's really interesting. So there are not really words for emotions in Yiddish. Do you know if that's true in other? I don't know language well enough. Like other languages, is that unique to Yiddish that it's very limited and narrow in its range of emotional vocabulary?
Now you're pushing my linguistic knowledge, but I don't know. But you generally see, right, other languages, even if you go to a foreign country, you know, and you see people speaking in a very animated, you know, kind of way. You can kind of like tell from tone, right, intonation and kind of body language, like generally how they are. I don't find that to be the case with Yiddish at all.
Really? Because I would have thought Yiddish does have so much of that, like, embodiment of, like flair or flavor in like the way people speak it. Like it's so rich in the,
but it's very,
you're not hearing me.
No, I am. It's intellectually rich, right? If you have kind of like the one liners, you know, that kind of like play on words, extraordinarily rich and deep and insightful, but it's here.
Mm, it's more like witticisms than it is like emotional expression.
Right. And
yeah,
great,
that's interesting.
They're great witticisms. They're fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So, yeah, I mean, I gave a talk recently at a teacher's conference in Chicago, and I was talking about this in the school system. I'm curious to know what you think of this. I think this is so interesting that if you think about our educational system, so my daughter now, I've one daughter who's five, who comes home every day with like a knapsack filled with like crinkled up papers of like art projects and coloring and, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? And then I have another son who's in second grade and another son in fourth grade, right? Even already by the second grade son, nothing, not one, right? Not, doesn't happen, right? So there's none of that kind of arts and crafts type stuff, right? So it's like the first like 2-3 years of the educational system is very heavy on the artistic, creative, natural expression side of the brain and of the body and of the person. And then it just goes completely dark, like completely cold. There's no there's no continuation. It's not like it tapers off. It goes like completely extinct. And then for the rest of the person's educational life, it's entirely focused on memorization, organization, analysis, etc., things of that nature. And it's such a radical shift. And what I was talking about, I'm sure you know this. I'd love to hear your comment on this. You know, when you look at like the neuroscience, neuropsychology, brain scans of the difference between very, very healthy brains and then brains that are experiencing more profound challenges, one of the most stark differences is that in the healthier brains, the different compartments of the brain are always integrated. So even if an experience is more of an emotional experience, but the intellectual part of the brain is also lit up. And when an experience is more intellectual, the emotional part is also lit up. It might be difference in how active it is, but there's always activity in the different regions and different compartments of the brain, and everything is always all on, just to differing degrees. In contrast with that, brains of people who have high levels of addiction, high levels of trauma, high levels of mental health challenges, etc., you find the opposite, where it's whenever one part of the brain is on, the other parts are completely off. And then when the other part is on, the first part is completely off. And so there's no integration between the different parts. And I think that a lot of that is seen in that system, that educational system, where we have the parts of the brain that are artistic, that are expressive, that are emotional, that are feeling, that are intuitive, are on, and then completely off, and then a complete switch.
100%. You know, like really well said. Like we're blessed with six daughters and two boys. And, you know, we kind of joke, you know, at the Shabbos table, Yontif, or whatever it is, that, you know, I can kind of give my daughters like a one word, just, you know, pick a word kind of almost randomly, and they have a song for it. And it's some sort of educational song, you know, about this, that, or the other thing. You know, they could tell me, you know, the 10 generations, you know, from Adam down to Noah and then to Avraham.
Right.
Who lived where and, you know, who got what and just, you know, who were the Malachim and, it, you know, just everything is a song and everything is, you know, kind of remembered that way. You know, even in English studies, you know, it's you know, capitals of states and, you know, whatever it is. When it comes to, you know, our boys' education, it's very, very much not that. You know, and I think this is really pulling, you know, at kind of, you know, not only the emotional part, but also the experiential part. You know, and if we kind of, you know, rely on teaching methods, you know, that worked for whatever generation or, you know, kind of, you know, are seen as tried and true and don't incorporate current knowledge about how kids live, I think, you know, as therapists, we kind of see sometimes the emotional deficits associated with that, whether it's, you know, not having the emotional language or your overall point of, well, let's call it the middle point, right, of not trusting the intuition. And then that broader point of how do we expect our boys to connect to godliness through learning or to connect to davening if we haven't really taught them what emotional and being part of an emotional relationship actually is, you know, and I think that that can pose a huge challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the ways that I see this in working with sex addiction, and then I want to come back to where you started, which is how does this show up in sexual abuse? One of the ways that I see this in working with sex addiction time and time again is with the spouses of sex addicts. Because what I've found to be nearly every single time that I've met the spouse of one of my clients, if my client is the person with the addiction, and then I've, you know, I have a session with the spouse, or if I'm working with the couple, almost every time, what I find is that the spouse knew all along. They always had a feeling. They always had a gut feeling. They always knew something was up. They knew something was not right. And they rationalized away those feelings, those kind of instinctive messages that were coming up. And they would rationalize to themselves why not to listen, why not to listen to themselves, and why not to tune into that. And that actually in the end becomes one of the hardest parts of the experience for them to heal from. Because more than learning to somehow forgive and somehow move forward with their spouse and the betrayal of their spouse, it's how to forgive themselves for having lied to themselves. Forget being lied to, but lied to themselves for the past 10 years, 20 years, whatever it is. And what it really was not listening to the body wisdom. One of the most extreme examples I've come across is a client of mine, and in this case, it was actually that the wife was the person with the addiction, and the husband was my client as the betrayed spouse, and he was waking up nightly having nightmares, in cold sweat that his wife was acting out with other men, and he was experiencing that on a consistent basis. But he had no knowledge of anything she was doing. He didn't actually have anything tangible, and so he just kind of, you know, suppressed it, and thought he was having bizarre nightmares. But it was coming to him, right? These messages were in his body. He knew, and so I mean, I see this a lot. The fallout of not learning to trust our body and our intuition all the time. And in that context, so I'm curious to come back to the context you brought off of sexual abuse and how you see that.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, kind of just to touch on the philosophical point, and then we'll, you know, maybe get more grounded in terms of, you know, the abuse and the perpetrator.
Yeah.
I think you make such a beautiful point in terms of how this all connects to, you know, to godliness. And you know, brought a, you know, a couple of examples in terms of like how this can be explained, you know, to people, or kind of just like to give them the insight, you know, to me, you know, Carl Jung, you know, as we know, spoke about this idea of a collective unconscious, right? And he had, you know, kind of this idea, that there are these, you know, that these kind of, you know, prototypes, you know, that we all, you know, kind of connect to. But to me, if we kind of, you know, take this idea of a collective unconscious, you know, and this is, you know, I think very much based in the 32nd chapter of Tanya, and the notion of this collective unconscious, right, that we're all literally cut from the same cloth. We might be very, very different shapes and sizes, but we're all cut from the same cloth, which means that we were once connected to this main cloth, which we call godliness. So it shouldn't be all that, you know, surprising that somehow we can pick up on the vibes of somebody else who's literally coming from the same cloth, but also connected.
Wow.
To
I never even thought about cloth, it like that. Wow.
Right. To this larger cloth of, well, God created the entire cloth. Like he imbued us with knowing everything. We're now just like this cutout piece. Right. But if we kind of like allow ourselves to reconnect to this whole thing, like it shouldn't be mysterious that we have feels and vibes about people all the time. And if you think about it, just one more small point, right? You see this in kids and babies, right? You see this in babies and kids all the time. We unlearn this ability to trust our intuition. You know, when you see young kids, right? And you have, you know, the person that's off or, you know, just kind of like a little shady or whatever it is, like babies respond to that, like right away, you know, the recoil and whatever it is. And, you know, we've kind of taught ourselves to not believe in it. So that's kind of the first point that I would make. And we will come back to abuse in 1 second, but maybe one more point. And that is, I think it's important that as therapists, we separate, you know, we're going to kind of encourage people, right, to trust the intuition, you know, trust the feeling, get in touch with, you know, kind of that that wisdom that's really held inside of their body. Sometimes I see, though, that people go to an opposite extreme. And when we speak about, right, the notion that the body keeps score and, you know, we have to be in tune and, you know, where do we feel this and where do we experience this? I think it's important to kind of distinguish. We're not asking people to make impulsive decisions. We're not asking people, yeah, you know, to kind of right away decide yes, no. You know, we're asking them to respect the feeling and to question it and to ask, why is it that I might be experiencing this? Why is it that I'm feeling this? Where am I feeling it? What is this triggering inside of me, right? To kind of engage in a process that's insightful in a deep, meaningful, experiential kind of way. We're not asking people to kind of, you know, decide in a moment whether they should, you know, be moving from this place to that place. Right.
Right.
And a lot of people,
I think
no, go ahead. Sorry.
Sorry. Go ahead. Finish the thought.
Yeah. No, a lot of times, sometimes people have this tendency to kind of like go to an opposite extreme and imagine that they're supposed to, you know, only be making, you know, a decision, you know, kind of like a snap decision. That's called impulsivity. That's not what we're asking people to do. We're asking people to recognize what it is that they're experiencing and be an investigator for themselves to try to really understand it and respect the fact that there's something that's being pulled and tugged at.
Yeah, I think that's such an incredibly important point because first off, I think like there's a difference between, as you said, between impulsivity and intuition. And I think impulsivity is what comes really quickly and on a very surface level. It's like if you imagine like the way I think about it is like an ocean or a body of water and you take like a cup and you just skim the surface of it, right? So that's like impulsivity. Intuition is like when you like try and lower much, much deeper down. And intuition in my mind is like the kol de mamadaka. It's the very still, small, quiet voice that's kind of beneath the rubble, beneath the surface, beneath the chaos of all these different things. It's like the gra that I don't remember if I actually quote in the book or not, but about rabos machshavos belevish v'atzas Hashem hisakum, that there's a person has many thoughts, but the advice, the counsel of God is what stands. And the way that the Vilna Gaon understands this is that our minds are and our bodies are filled with all sorts of thoughts. There's a lot going on, many, many, many thoughts. But there's one of them that kind of stands out, but it's in that big mixture. And the way that the Baal Shem Tov, I think, would slightly reformulate that is that within every thought there are many different pieces, and within every thought there's that piece beneath the surface. It's not just one amidst the many, but there's a one within every one. But that difference in intuition and impulsivity, I think, is really important. And then also just to emphasize what you were saying. Going back to what I was talking about before with the healthy brains versus the brains that have been really, adversely affected. So the example I was giving before about the healthy brains, that all the different compartments are always integrated with each other. So one of the examples I gave is even when you're in a very emotional experience, the intellectual part of the brain is not shut off in the healthy brain, right? So it's really about integration. And I'm really happy you're bringing this point up because I do think it's a really important point, and that the idea of body wisdom or any of this type of language is not about compartmentalizing and emphasizing the intuitive or the artistic or the emotional more than the intellectual necessarily. It's about making sure that they each have their proper place and their proper say and proper expression in an integrated and balanced kind of way.
Yeah.
Coming back to
Go ahead. Come back to it.
No. I want to hear what you say. I'm sorry. I think there might be like a second delay, which is why I wasn't sure if you were about to say something.
There's a famous vort, from the Sagachavar, in the back of many Gemaras, there's the tefillah before and tefillah after you learn. And we quote the pasuk Gali Neinu Vinabita, right? Traditionally it's translated, right? Kind of uncover our eyes and we'll be able to see. And the Sagar Chavar says that Gal is a lashon of a wave, right? We have all of these waves of thoughts that come and we don't ask them to come, right? We don't sit there saying like, okay, thoughts, like come on in, right? We're just kind of like inundated with all of these waves, right? We can allow them to come in, right? And then they go out. So Gali Neinu Vinabita, right, is these waves come in. I can actively choose, right, which one of these I'm going to embrace and which one of these, right, I'm going to investigate further. Which I think, very much is in line, not only with the work that we do, right? I mean, how many people that we work with are just inundated with these constant thoughts. and they imagine that, you know, they are their thoughts, and, you know, look how horrible and terrible I am, you know, with the thoughts. And one of the points, right, brought down in this in this void of the Sagaj, you can't control the fact that you're having this inundation, right, this overflow of thoughts. You can control which one you wind up latching onto, and that's very much under your control. And I think, you know, that very much goes in line with what it is that we're speaking about, right? We can have a lot of rational thoughts about, you know, kind of what it is, what I'm connecting to, right? Which thought I'm connecting to that might have, you know, some sort of visceral or deeper response, right? That's really what we want to try to get people to focus on, to ultimately, I think, to have a better understanding of themselves.
Gal, wow. Really beautiful. Never heard that. Gal. That's great. So the question that I always get when I talk about this topic, I'm sure you get this too, is, okay, so how do I start accessing that? Right? So how do I work on that? How do I get better at that? So I know what I usually answer, but I'm very interested and curious to hear what would you say to somebody who's listening and says, okay, this is really interesting and I can hear why it's important, and how do I start?
My answer to them is, you do it all the time. You don't have to learn a new skill except for recognizing that you do it all the time. It's happening.
But what if I don't? What if I live in my head, only in my head?
Right. So we could do a little exercise, right? And that exercise, right?
Let's go for it.
No, this is what I'm telling them, but we could do it too, right? Is I want you to just close your eyes, right? And I don't want you to pay attention to anything that the voices in your head, right? No matter how great, I want you to not pay attention to them at all. I just want you to pay attention to where you feel tight and clenched. And then, you know, then they're like, well, my feet, my buttocks, my, you know, pelvic area, my, you know, my arms, my, that, great. Congratulations. You just did it. And it's all practice from there, right? To be able to say, right, this very much, you know, goes in the realm of mindfulness and just being in tune. We intuit all the time. It's not a new skill. All we have to learn is to recognize that it's happening, not making it happen. It'll happen whether you like it or not. The question is, you know, kind of, are you tuning into that frequency? You know, and some simple exercises, you know, make it, you know, kind of make it much more obvious, right, that we're basing it on an intuition. You know, sometimes...
So can I make an assumption and ask a personal question?
Sure.
So, okay, the assumption is embedded in the question. So the question is, how did you come to be good at this for yourself?
Good at what? I'm not. I want to make sure.
at living in this way, of being integrated. You know, these different parts of ourselves, and allowing those sensations in, and taking them seriously, and being tuned into my feelings while also being connected to the intellectual and etc.
So first of all, thank you for the compliment. You know, definitely work in progress, you know, something that I put at high value, you know, so definitely constant work. I think it goes, you know, from early parenting, ongoing relationships with Rebbeim that, you know, really experience life, you know, kind of in this way, you know, in this very, very incorporated kind of way. I think there's also, you know, we learn what we feel connected to. So, you know, whether it's, you know, kind of, you know, whether it's a spiritual experience or honestly, whether it's professional experience, you know, I think we all, you know, kind of do and learn about what's, you know, kind of intuitively what feels right. You know, so this kind of like branch of psychology, you know, I think is extraordinarily old. it took a break, you know, for a couple of hundred years. And then, it's, you know, very much, I think, you know, seeing this resurgence, it, you know, in fairness, I think it had a lot to do with the mindfulness chevra, you know, who kind of, you know, very much brought this back. But, you know, it's kind of like a very natural place for addiction therapists to go, for trauma therapists to go, because there is that understanding that, you know, in the end of the day, the body keeps the score. You know, and that's just the reality. And if we're not somehow, and it really doesn't matter how, if we're not somehow incorporating that intuitive body knowledge into the work, it's virtually incomplete.
Hmm. Yeah. So this was something that you kind of came to naturally, but then worked on, meaning you got this in your childhood.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. It kind of made sense to me. You know, kind of like always, mm-hmm. I think always kind of like good at reading people, you know, sometimes knowing it, sometimes not, you know, kind of knowing whether, you know, the person I was interacting with, whether they just needed, you know, kind of like the straight answer, or whether they needed like a little kibitz, you know, to kind of like, you know, open them up, you know, a little bit, you know, I think that kind of came intuitively. Was it something I said?
Yeah. Okay. So I know I had told you we would, I would take your time for like 30 to 40 minutes. So I know we're nearing the end. So maybe just, and I wasn't dead set on talking about sexual abuse. It's just one of the first things that came up. So let's just spend the last few minutes kind of looping back around to how all of this impacts that, because I know that's one of the primary areas that you really specialize in.
Yeah. So I would say for sexual abuse victims, as well as, you know, the male spouses of female sexual abuse victims, unless they're getting in tune with how the sexual abuse affected them physically and where it affected them physically, and
Hi, there we go.
Okay. We were speaking about sexual abuse victims. You know, male sexual abuse victims in general, right, are generally, as a group, are extraordinarily confused when the sexual abuse, you know, took place, you know, kind of as a kid. There's, you know, a body feeling that this was ichi, yachi, inappropriate. There's also a body feeling of pleasure, excitement, interest, and the rational brain, you know, kind of has a really tough time putting those two things together and integrating them. And we kind of, you know, have been taught that in the world of rational, right, in the world of logic, you can't have two opposites coming together. You need to be miyashev the stira, right? It needs to have a logical conclusion. Was it this or was it this? As soon as you present to somebody the world of emotion, that the two things are not in conflict with one another, they both simultaneously exist, and they're both very, very true, that can be very, very freeing. You know, in the chapter, you speak about shame, you know, to a certain extent, I think it's also about guilt. This can be very freeing, right, about guilt, because a lot of sexual abuse victims, walk around feeling that their body betrayed them, and that there's, you know, kind of like almost a constant body betrayal that's taking place. One of the main effects of sexual abuse, you know, in men is hypersexuality. And so a lot of men experience this notion that, I was sexually abused. Now I kind of live in a state of hyperarousal. My body is working against me. And, you know, as we're kind of like able to do that work of the emotions, you know, kind of living in concert, and we don't have to choose, right, between one option or another, that can be very, very freeing. That's, you know, kind of part one. And part two is kind of, you know, very much getting in tune with where the abuse impacted and affected them. And you know, often that's not only, in terms of, you know, kind of like pelvic girdle area, but can be in terms of like heightened awareness, right? All the PTSD type, you know, symptoms that we see, you know, somebody living in a state of hyper arousal, you know, the deflection, the depersonalization, not feeling safe enough to be part of that feeling, right? And kind of experience what it is that's happening. You know, very often we'll speak to sexual abuse victims and they'll tell us about their dissociation. You know, for people who aren't familiar, right? Dissociation is when our mind kind of goes somewhere else to protect us from feeling what it is that we're experiencing now. So, you know, sexual abuse victims will tell, like, you know, what we say would be the strangest, you know, parts of their experience, you know, that counting the number of tiles on the ceiling, or, you know, how many light bulbs were out, you know, in the place. That's all dissociation. That's all, you know, this desire of our body to protect us, you know, from what it is that was going on. The problem is that that's a cognitive process, but what was still happening physically is very much there. And as we're able to help people kind of integrate, well, let's get back to that experience. Let's get back to what it is that you experienced and do that in a safe way. You know, for many, that's really where the healing takes place. But again, this theme of, you know, my body has betrayed me, you know, this can come up in terms of erectile dysfunctioning, premature ejaculation, hypersexuality, addiction, you know, type of issues, potentially the themes of pornography that people are watching. You know, it can kind of come up in a myriad of ways.
Yeah. So would it be, I guess one way to put it maybe would be that everything we've been talking about until now is true kind of in a cultural general sense for most people. What I mean by that is the kind of the numbness or the lack of connectivity and respect, let's say, that a person gives their body sensations and body intuition and body wisdom and feelings and all of those kinds of things, and kind of focusing nearly exclusively, not exclusively, but nearly exclusively on the rational. That's true as a cultural overall kind of landscape. But then for people who have experienced sexual abuse, that goes up quite a few notches in that it's not just kind of a cultural numbness of the intuitive feeling part of themselves and their body, but it's that there's actually so much chaos that took place in their body that their mind is not just numbing their body, but actually running away from their body. And the body is a place of so much danger for them. It's a site to escape from. So it kind of it exists kind of on a continuum. It just jumps a whole bunch of notches up on that scale.
Yes, 100%. 100%. I think really well said.
Yeah. So last question to end with. Do you think that we are starting to do better as a community in shifting this kind of more wholesome, holistic way of approaching ourselves in our lives? Do you think we're just kind of status quo, or do you think we're getting worse at it, or different in different ways?
It's a great question. You know, I tell everybody that kind of, you know, asks, you know, similar kinds of questions. And that is, therapists are the worst people to ask this question to, because nobody has right. ever knocked on our door and said, by the way, my life is fantastic. Let me tell you about it. Right. So we kind of have like this, you know, totally skewed sample, right, of, you know, kind of what it is that's actually occurring in the world. I can tell you, you know, kind of like stepping back, you know, your book, the ability for that to come out, you know, Dr. Shlomi Zimmerman that just came out, you know, with you know, From Boys to Men, you know, the fact that by and large, you know, there's been a tremendous community acceptance about how to speak to boys about puberty and those kinds of things. You know, Dr. Benji Epstein, mindfulness, type books, Judah Michelle, David Weinberg, right? Being able, the spoken word, right? The fact that these issues are coming up and being made into something very, very practical, I think, says a lot. I think problems are always going to be problems. We talk about this in terms of mandating parent training, in schools. The people that need to be there, right? Generally, they show up, and the people that need to be there don't show up, and the people that don't need to be there, they're the ones that are showing up. So I think there's always going to be, some sort of continuum. We've definitely gotten a whole lot better in terms of sexual abuse prevention programs, which is absolutely fantastic. I think there's, definitely been kind of, more acceptance with that. Sometimes the pendulum swings, right, to the other way, where any and all activity is kind of seen, right, as this person is the next budding, perpetrator. I got a call yesterday from a lawyer from a school who wants to know how to deal with, two 6-year-olds who were engaged in, some sort of sexual play or, whatever it is. And it's like, well, I don't have to, that's completely normative. We have to teach them. That's what we right. have to do. And be supportive and encouraging. The fact that the school called a lawyer, right, to kind of call the therapist to find out that's pendulum swing, right, in a crazy kind of way. So hopefully we'll find the middle and we'll find the balance, but there's no question that the sense of awareness is there. And it's like anything else, those that yearn and those that seek, they're tremendous resources that are available.
As Rav Kook writes, I'm sure I'm not going to quote it exactly right, but as Rav Kook writes, the truly righteous don't complain about the darkness, they add light. They don't complain about ignorance, they add wisdom, etc. And a few more lines of that sort of message. So hopefully we can try and add to that. Thank you so much for this conversation. I think I'll just highlight for me, so much of what you said was really, really profound, but I really never thought about how the ability to have intuition about the world really could be rooted in a kind of unity of all existence, being rooted in a oneness, going back to chapter 32, Perek Lamed Bey's Lev of the Tanya, and that kind of idea. I'm walking out with that. Thank you.
It'll be in the next printing,
Yeah. Did I ever tell you that the I'm an inical of the Alter Rebbe, so it's especially meaningful.
Oh, wow. There you go.
There you go. Yeah. My mother's maiden name is Schneerson. We're straight from the Baal Tanya. Yeah. So thank you. I never thought about it in that light. All right, Dr. Fagan, thanks so much for spending this time with me.
Pleasure.
Conversation to be continued.
Shalom.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please follow us on WhatsApp, YouTube, or Instagram. All our podcast series can be found wherever you listen to podcasts. I'd love to hear from you, so please reach out with questions, comments, or suggestions, or to be added to our WhatsApp groups. You can reach us through email using yakov.attached@gmail.com or on WhatsApp at 773-888-2413.